to another episode of Hip Hop Social Worker. I'm your host, Christopher Scott. And today I have a special guest, Mr. Josh McNeil, out in Boston. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. And he's a fellow social worker. And he can tell you a little more about himself than I can. So go ahead and introduce yourself to the people.
Good morning or good day, whatever it comes out. Happy to, you know, talk to you all. I'm Josh McNeil. I'm a clinical social worker hailing out of Boston, Massachusetts. I'm not from here, but, you know, this is where I went to grad school. I went to Florida A&M University, which is an HBCU. After FAMU, I thought I was going to be a lawyer, mm-hmm. but I found out I was really, you know, I had so much, and I guess maybe we can get into it too. I had a lot of experience working with youth from, you know, working, you know, working as an RA in college to being a camp counselor. So I'm a camp counselor at an Army base in Germany, American Army base in Germany, to being at a American embassy in Tokyo working with Japanese children and foreign service children, and then you know, military dependent children at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. After, you know, all that, graduated from FAMU, thought I was gonna do law, but I did city year, Boston. Mm-hmm. And my manager there was like, you know, Josh, I know you want to do this whole lawyer thing, but, you know, I can't see you without working with kids. So, you know, I applied to the Boston College School of Social Work. You know, did children, youth, and family with a clinical concentration. You know, I worked at like a outpatient, well, not outpatient, like a day program, mm-hmm. a partial hospital program, and also at a school. And then after that, if y'all know a little bit about Boston, man, Boston, the special type of racism that hit, man, it'll do something to you. So I went back to where I'm originally from, Brooklyn, New York. I was a clinical social worker. Well, I was a clinical case manager in Brooklyn, doing home visits and, you know, mental health assessments and what have you. And then in the same organization, I was a clinical social worker in our Harlem office. And then, you know, I thought, there's still some good opportunities in Boston. So, you know, I came back and, you know, based upon certain little clearance things, I can't say the hospital, but, you know, I work at a hospital now as a behavioral health clinician, mm-hmm. Working with violence recovery and prevention. And then I'm also... I'm a fee-for-service clinician at a university here, like one day a week. And, you know, in both places I do mental health assessments. I do, the intakes. I do individual counseling, lead groups, you know, risk assessments. That's basically it.
That's a lot of stuff, man. That is... Yeah. That's what's up. I feel like the more like people that I meet that have the LCSW, they do a lot of stuff. It's like they really push it to the max. You know what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. you know, like, so like that's one thing you know, just sitting down and talking with different social workers and you know, in like in other professions in this, you know, in this field of work, it's like I feel like everybody who gets a license is just. It's like nonstop grind, and I like that, you know right. what I'm saying, because it's like freedom to, you know, to work, you know, how you work, when you work, you know what I'm saying, because, you know, like, just what I've learned in my short time of having my MSW, it'll be 2 years in June, just like a lot of places that you work are just like buried in like politics and things like that. Oh. and it's hard to
That's
really
half the battle.
You know what I'm saying? So like and it's hard to really get anywhere, you know what I'm saying, with your clients and the people you're trying to help when you like worried about all this other stuff, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know.
I mean, with the whole LCA Massachusetts in New York, I was an LMSW. Mm-hmm. I guess I still am. And then in that's your first level. And then Massachusetts, your first license is LC. But my next, the clinical one, the last one, mm-hmm. is the LICSW. So I'm still working on my, you know, my final licensure, getting my hours, my supervision, my CEUs and stuff like that. It's different in Massachusetts, so.
Yeah, I know in Oregon you just got to get your CSWA, which I got, and then from there you get your LCSW, and then I don't know if you got to get the LICSW. I've seen that popping up in in other regions, but I don't know if Oregon. I mean, hopefully they don't, because if they want to find any way to get another, some money from you, they're gonna get it. But I remember when I was in high school, I really wanted to go to FAMU. You know what I'm saying?
Oh wow!
Yeah, I did, because it was like the first school I really heard of, and but I remember I was a freshman in high school, and I remember thinking the out of state tuition, and I was like, it scared the hell out of me. So I backed all the way up. But I remember I did. I was very intrigued with that school. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
So basically, I mean, you gave a little background, but was there a path you took to get to social work? I mean, I know you just share a lot of your experience, but was there was there something that kind of led you to this field of work, besides what you already said?
I would say just people. I would say a lot of times I'm not the best in seeing stuff within myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say my family, my grandmother and my mom, they kind of had me on the path somewhat, to talk me into it, having mentors to talk me into it. But I would say specifically, there was a student when I was in City Year, Boston. And City Year, for all you don't know, City Year is it's in the same, kind of the same realm as Teach for America or Peace Corps, but it's more of an urban Peace Corps where you're working on attendance initiatives, behavior initiatives, mm-hmm. and coursework initiatives. And there'll be people who are young people who they'll score or they'll have some type of thing to where they'll catch somebody who needs some extra support. So we called it in City Year a starfish.
Yeah.
And there's a young person that was a starfish to me. We just had a starfish is somebody, I'm sorry, in City Year terms, meaning somebody that you have a bond with and you're able to impact. Mm. And that starfish, I would help that young person with after school homework, met their parents, always read with them, have lunch with them, just give them that one-on-one time and help them to get their grades up. Mm-hmm. I think that was a moment where I felt as though that mentorship or just that, I guess that, in a sense, my clinical charismatic people skills, interpersonal skills, were what helped me to realize, I can really do this. And I think it was more so definitely in the City of Boston where I realized, after people had saw me and my interactions with my starfish and they saw the work that I was doing and also leading we had a City Year team,
mm-hmm.
leading them around the City of Boston to Martin Luther King, where he used to live, Malcolm X's house, where he used to live, taking them to different civic places and historical places. Going to different community activists. There's a brunch in Boston called the Mel King Brunch.
Yeah.
Mel King is a brother, a black man. He's probably 90 or so. He was almost mayor in 1983, and he's been doing a brunch in his house every Sunday for about 50 years or so. Mm. I mean, you have professors that have come through there, and just that trajectory of meeting people, meeting with activists, meeting professors, meeting with other social workers, meeting with therapists, that put me on that path to go and get my MSW, I would say, along with all the stuff with, working as, again, our RA, having international experience, working with youth. That was the trajectory I was on. So it was all that.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of how I got into the therapist realm. I never heard of MSW until I was about to graduate undergrad. And I was okay, but even with that, I didn't even know what you can do with the MSW. I just knew that it was MSW. But then, when I start meeting people in the field, I was like, okay, well, that makes a little bit of sense. So I started just, talking to different, professionals and just, you know, talking to different people who, like, had, like, a lot of experience in the field and seeing, you know, seeing, like, the kind of work they was doing. I was like, all right, maybe I can get into this, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's cool. I feel like, I was never a person to, like, network or, like, talk to people when I was younger. I mean, like, it just seemed odd to me, you know what I'm saying? Because, I don't know, I'm like, you know, it's, like, prideful in a sense. It's like, you know, like, I don't know, I was always kind of, like, I'm just, like, shook to, like, you know, reach out and be like, hey, do you want, like, is it all right if we sit down and have a conversation? You know, but then, mm-hmm. you know, talking to different people, it's like, well, that's how you really, you know, that's how you build your network, you know what I'm saying?
Definitely.
Like, because it's rare that, I mean, yeah, you could, like, it could happen, but it's rare that somebody's going to, like, you know, wait around and, you know what I'm saying, and, like, want you to, like, you know, say, wait around and want them to, like, you know, come talk to you first, you know what I'm saying? Like, especially mm-hmm. if you ain't got no notoriety, you know what I'm saying? That's just kind of how it is. You got to build that up. And to build that up, you got to kind of, you know, you got to do the footwork.
Definitely.
You know what I'm saying? So, what kind of things, like, influence your practice? Or, like, what kind of things, like, you incorporate, you know what I'm saying, like, into your interventions and your, you know, saying the way you reach out and, you know, like, the mm-hmm. way you just kind of move in social work?
I think it depends per client, but, you know, of course, like, CBT,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's, you know, just a good basis. I think working with, and I hope nobody, you know, facts only's me or whatever, mm-hmm. hashtag facts only. I need to get more into the narrative base, because okay. I feel as though with narrative based therapy, I think more for, like, Black, and I have a lot of Black and Latino clients, I would say, all, right?
Yeah.
They like to be heard. They like to be validated with some things about, this is your story. Tell me a little bit about this. How can I be of assistance on this path as you tell me and we kind of process things? Because I think sometimes overstructure, and I've been told I've been too structured at times in my practice.
Yeah.
And what I do, I think that sometimes overstructure, it could be a good, for me, that's how I work, but a lot of our clients, they just like to come in, have a casual conversation. And I think the narrative approach that I need to more so get into, that is what gets more the clients, the people that we support, kind of more open to talk about their stories. I used to be so structured to where I used to always have stuff printed out, mm-hmm. little worksheets and stuff like that before. And then my supervisor in Harlem was like, Josh, why don't you just go in there and talk? Like, having a conversation. And I was like, you can just do that? You can't just, like, I thought I had to have this printed out, that printed out. She was like, nah, like, you can do that. But try more so with just going in there and speaking to them.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, the questions, the, you know, biopsychosocials and as far as, like, harm to themselves, anybody else, the mental health history, any trauma that they've had, all that stuff. Like, once that stuff gets out the way, just, you know, it's just more of a sense of a conversation. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've done. And I would say therapistaid.org or .com is a great resource. They have a lot of different things to where, like, handouts and videos and stuff that I've used, you know, in my practice.
Yeah.
I think also Joy DeGruy, who actually went to Portland State,
yep.
get a PhD in social work.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not really – a thing she kind of impressed upon me is just, like, at least in the Black community, just giving a head nod, right?
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledging that you see somebody. Like, I took that for granted, and as an African-American male, I think it's so much that I do probably that I don't know – oh, that's a cultural thing. To where it's like, when she named it, I realized that, you know, if a client comes in, it's like, oh, I, you know, give him a head nod. Like, you know, I work in the hospital, so you may see him around. Just acknowledging people's presence, especially in the Black community, because if they feel like, you know, you're not looking at them or not acknowledging them, then that's, like, probably a snub. But then, you know, the code of ethics and social work is like, if they see you, you see, they're supposed to initiate it first. So it's always that
mm-hmm.
that line to where it's like, the code of ethics says they're supposed to approach, and I let them know, because Boston's small, you see me around, not give me a nod, this and that. But then, you know, some supervisors be like, who are black, and be like, yeah, I hear that, but you got to toe that line between, like, you can't go out and say, how you doing this and that, but, you know, just giving them that acknowledgement. And I think that's kind of where they probably need some more, like, black people, people of color, brown people, in those rooms with NASW and all this social work stuff, because, you know, it's very white, women-based.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you saying that reminded me of an episode of the show I used to watch called Blackish. And there was an episode where his son saw another, like, young black kid, and he didn't say nothing to him. And the dad was like, did you acknowledge that young man's presence? And he was like, well, no, why? Mm-hmm. He was like, to let him know that he, you know what I'm saying? You know, so, like, yeah, it's like a cultural thing, you know what I'm saying? Like, especially in Portland, our black community has shrunk, you know what I'm saying? Well, not really shrunk, but, like, just kind of, it used to be concentrated, and they spread us out. You know what I'm saying? So now it's like when you see somebody, you know what I'm saying? You just look, you see him, you give him a head nod to let him know, like, hey, I see you. You know what I'm saying? You ain't alone out here. You know?
Bro, like, I think one time, I think you had posted something about this difference between Portland and Portlandia.
Oh, yeah. Granted,
I love Portlandia. It's like a very mindless, satirical, you gotta be, it's very a cerebral show.
Yeah.
And you know, I heard from you and I heard from others, like, yo, Portland ain't sweet. You know what I'm saying? It ain't all about the microbreweries and all this eclectic art and, you know, all the food trucks. And I heard years ago, Portland is where 30-year-olds go to retire.
It seems that way. Mm-hmm. It seems that way when you look around and, like, on a Tuesday, and everybody kind of hanging out, you know what I'm saying? It definitely seems that way. But Portland, yeah, there is a difference between Portland and Portlandia. I mean, I feel like as popular as Portlandia got, people tried to make it, like, act like it'd be the actual Portland, you know what I'm saying? But, like, you know, I mean, so some of that stuff does seem like a little, like, you know, real. I mean, not real, but, like, it just seemed like, oh, okay, that seemed like something that would happen in Portland. You know, like the episode. It's
believable.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? The episode where they were talking about were the chickens happy, you know what I'm saying? Were these chickens happy when they laid these eggs and that kind of stuff? Because it seems like that kind of stuff happens, but... But, yeah, there is a difference. I mean, like, me growing up in the late 80s and early 90s, there definitely wasn't a lot of Portlandia stuff that I felt. But as the years went on, I was like, all right, this is okay. I see what's happening, you know. But, you know, it's like a love-hate, you know what I'm saying? I don't know if I could maneuver anywhere else. Like, this is home to me. But seeing how it's changed just... Something, you know, it's bittersweet, I'm not gonna lie. You know what I'm saying? And that's a whole lot of stuff that I can unpack right there. But you know, I don't know if we got the time today. But but yeah, so in a profession like social work, you know what I'm saying, where we meet with clients and it could take like one meeting to get a breakthrough, or it could take 100, you know what I'm saying, to get a breakthrough. How do you gauge success, you know what I'm saying? In your practice?
Whew. Man, that's a good question. I think, I'm going to be real, I don't know the answer to that. Because there's so many different types of people that you come across that you have to look at it from the lens of that interpersonal experience. Mm-hmm. But what I can say is, I think one of the things is just like how I can gauge success is them coming in and just talking to you consistently, them, like, me not having to run after them too much. Maybe the answer is the question. Maybe, because sometimes, you know, you can, what I do is, I'll email them, or not email, I'll text or call, maybe, like, 48 hours ahead to see if they're going to come to the, you know, to the appointment, and they come. But it's sometimes where, you know, we have a rule where if you make more than... The limit is outreach 3 times. So, like, text or call, you can only do that 3 times. And if they don't come, then you just kind of leave it at that and let the chips fall where they may. But I think just them coming in consistently, following up. But we also know with mental health that sometimes people may not be in the right, you know, mental state to always come up, do this, do that. So there's that fine line. I think one success that I definitely had was when I was a a social worker in Harlem, and there's a young man who he had so many. He was 18, mm-hmm. and he had so many struggles with what his father told him about masculinity. I can't say a lot of this stuff, but it was just very toxic. Mm-hmm. Like basically, you gotta no man should show emotion only when I can't even say mm-hmm. or. You know, you can't be a punk, and fighting is the one way we should be able to do this and do that. And after having a lot of conversation, weeks after weeks after weeks, he finally just broke down. He didn't break down emotionally, but he was like, really? Because he would always get, you know, like, very combative with me mm-hmm. about what his father taught him. But I would say, and then, you know, I would tell him, I don't want to take anything away from what your father has told you. Yeah. But just to let you know, there are also ways that you can look at your masculinity in dealing with women and in having conversations, how to de-escalate situations with men. There's more than one ways to do things.
Yeah.
And after weeks and weeks and weeks of him being combative with me or him not coming, one day he just sat in my office and he was like, you know something? I can really do it like that. I'm not going to be less of a man. And you just, I remember him looking. He looked out the window, and you saw, like, the you saw him processing. You saw the wheels in motion in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I made an impact. I definitely had to get supervision for it afterwards because it was just a breakthrough.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's, you know, that's what I'm in to work for. I mean, I really like to, you know, be there for us as black men, yeah. right? I feel as though, in my standpoint, from what I've seen in my experience, we always see black men get services after the fact. So yeah. I sometimes may have to get somebody across my desk that is somebody who was a stab victim or a gunshot wound victim. What about the services for these brothers beforehand, mm-hmm. right? I feel as though people like me and you are able to be there for them before these things escalate and these situations, you know, blow up. And I think we are a great preventative, especially, I'm going to just put it out there, black male clinicians. There needs to be more of us. There needs to be more support. There needs to be more resources
yeah.
And things for us to be able to help all these brothers because there's more of us in there. There's more of, you know, young brothers coming in and getting services. And they're not gunshot wound victims. There's a guy, I know you're the hip-hop social worker.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy named Wayno from Everyday Struggle.
Okay, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And he was saying, I saw something on Twitter, and he was saying, there's so many so-called real NIGGAs that are in jail because they didn't have the skills to de-escalate or talk them way out of something.
Yeah.
To feel like, oh, I got to be a man. I got to ride and do this and do that. And I feel like that's not what it's about, you know?
Yeah.
It's about just being, like, I like the way how the NBA Players Association, they have, like, a whole mental wellness division.
Mm-hmm.
They got DeMar DeRozan talking about, you know, his depression or anxiety. It's good that we're in a space now to talk about these things or to talk about what Big Sean, some people feel like, it was a cop-out because he used that to sell his records, but yeah. that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's Big Sean talking about mental health. There's Kid Cudi. There's so many different avenues. And shit, I mean, the Ghetto Boys, my mind's playing tricks on me.
Mm-hmm.
It goes way back even to then.
Yeah.
And I feel as though, we're not a monolith, but at least from the start, from a mainstream, there's ways as far as, like, in music and in sports to where we could talk about some things, and they need people like us so we can be better for our families, be better for our communities, be better within each other. Like, I lead a young men's group in Roxbury, which is like the Harlem of Boston. And it was a discussion on relationships.
Yeah.
And it was Valentine's Day. And, you know, we just generally talked about, you know, what's Valentine's Day? What are relationships? What are bonds? And the guys, you know, they're like probably 16 and 21. They're juvenile, they're justice involved, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them have these mentalities to where it's like, oh, Valentine's Day is for women. You got to show them, give them the cards, and you got to do the romance thing. And to eat for, if that's what you do, okay. And then I also kind of said, like, what is it like to show love to another man? And they're like, they felt as though they got real awkward. They thought it was, like, gay, or they got real just, they got quiet. But I'm like, if that's who you are, whether you are gay or not, it's okay to be that. It's also okay to be a heterosexual male and say, I love you, man.
Yeah.
And you to have a bond with a man and just be confident and healthy in that.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with showing your vulnerabilities, and I kind of just put it out there and I kind of normalize it. And we talk about these things and how to have, you know, safe boundaries and how to have a good foundation with somebody, and the types of relationships there are with anybody, regardless of their background, especially us as men to men, black men to black men, you know?
Yeah, I feel that. You know, I just think about how, like, the narrative of masculinity is changing now, and I kind of think about when I was in high school of, like, how that probably could have benefited me. Because, you know what I'm saying? Because I really, there were, you know, like, you had your friends back in the early 2000s, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, the masculinity thing wasn't really up for debate. It's like you had to move a certain way, or it was going to be hard for you, you know what I'm saying, out here. So I just remember, like, having, like, you know, in high school and being my friends be talking. And I remember, like, it was weak to, like, only date one girl. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, like, you can date one girl, but, you know what I'm saying, but that's your main girl. You're supposed to have, you know what I'm saying, other girls on, you know what I'm saying, that kind of stuff. And I was like, damn, like I really didn't want to do that. But, of course, you know what I'm saying, you had to kind of have to play the game, because that was the game that was being played. So, like, I feel like, you know what I'm saying, like, if that conversation would have started years ago, you know what I'm saying, like, my high school probably could have experienced, maybe would have been a little bit different, you know what I'm saying? And, like, I'm appreciative of, like, you know, of, like, you know, like, the Kid Cudis and the Big Seans and, you know, all them coming out and being honest, because it wasn't a lot of that in hip-hop when I was, you know, saying, when I was coming up. It was like, you know, 50 and, you know what I'm saying, Ja Rule and Ying Yang Twins. Jay-Z. You know, yeah, you know what I'm saying, the old Jay-Z.
Lloyd Banks.
You know what I'm saying, so, you know.
Masculine.
You see what I'm saying? And that really wasn't something I was really into, you know what I'm saying? Like, I wasn't really, like, a tough guy. I kind of had to act like I was with it, because that's just what you have to do. But, you know what I'm saying, I just wanted to chill and, you know, do my thing, you know what I'm saying?
I was definitely more of a Pharrell kid, you know?
Yeah, I feel that.
I wanted to just sit back, be cool. Am I bad for cutting you off?
That's all good.
I was more of that. And Winston Duke was talking about on the Breakfast Club the other day about why do we, as black men, somebody was saying, like, why is it you got to be able to fight? You can't smile. And how he said he has to use his words and he has to sound educated just so he's safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that I also try to talk with my young men about, like, you know, what are some different words in your vocabulary? Because they keep it, they be like, ah, or, you know, I, or, you know what I'm saying, or, okay, that's cool, I got you.
Yeah.
We can meet them where they're at, but I try to just be who I am. Hopefully that'll be an example. Just to, like, there's different types of masculinity, black masculinity, that you can be in. Of course, like, you can be, like you were saying, kind of, like, more chill, laid back. You don't gotta be, as Cat Williams says, gangbanging on bacon at 9 a.m. Who got time for that all the time? It's high blood pressure, man.
Yeah.
Chill, eat my oatmeal, eat my coffee, be at my desk.
You know,
wave. That's about it, man. Anybody got time for all that?
I feel that. I definitely feel that. I actually seen somebody commented on the movie Us. Since you're speaking about masculinity, and they said that you know, the movie. A critique of their movie, now this is a random person I seen online, a critique of their movie was it made the black man look weak. And I'm thinking, because Winston Duke wasn't really, you know, his role in the movie, he wasn't really trying to, You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, yeah, he fought, you know what I'm saying, when he was pushed, but, you know, like, to me, like, it seemed like he wasn't really trying to, you know, have any kind of encounter. He was kind of, like, trying to, like, you know, like, you know, let's just let it pass. You know, they're mm-hmm. outside, you know, let's see what happens. And, you know, like, he wasn't out there, you know what I'm saying, you know, trying to, you know, like, engage in conflict. So I feel like, you know, that was an interesting critique of them saying it made the black man look weak, but then again, that goes to the hyper-masculinity stuff. It's like, okay, so now I'm saying you're supposed to be, you know what I'm saying, going out there and fighting all four of the people, you know, but it's like, mm-hmm. hey, sometimes people, you know, it ain't really about all that, you know what I'm saying? But, you know what I'm saying, but in the movie, you got the brother wearing glasses, you know what I'm saying, wearing them, you know what I'm saying, wearing the sweater, you know what I'm saying, like, you know, like, he looked a little Carlton-ish, you know what I'm saying, but, you know, but then somebody said that it made us look weak. It's like, damn, like, I didn't like that comment. I was like, that's kind of, you know what I'm saying? Like, especially after I saw the movie, I was like, damn, like how? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't get how it make anybody look weak. But, you know, if you got a vision of masculinity in your head of, like, you know, it's supposed to be like, I'm supposed to be ready for a funk 24/7, you know what I'm saying? No matter. And then I guess it did make, I mean, yeah, that's just my little rant. But
no, it's true. I mean, these are the types of issues. Or these are the constructs that us is, well, you know, I'll say for myself, I'm my own work in progress. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a proponent of, as clinicians, as therapists, you know, we take in a lot of stuff from people. So it's good for us to go. And I know, you know, I think we're going to maybe talk about this self-care. I mm-hmm. do go to a therapist myself.
Yeah.
You know, like, I go to make sure it's like, it's a lot of stuff coming to me in this work environment, but I also have my stuff. And I think the more, as clinicians, we look ourselves in the mirror, it's easier. I don't say easier, but it's a different type of conversation that we can have with people because, you know, it's a slippery slope if you don't kind of work within yourself mm-hmm. and then you don't work with others. But that's what I do for self-care. And with these constructs, these are some of the constructs that we've all kind of dealt with. And these are the constructs that the young people coming across into our facilities or hospitals or universities,
yeah.
they're battling too. So I think it's definitely something good to, you know, talk about because, you know, you can be in a situation where you don't want to do something, but you actually go through it. Mm-hmm. And then you're looking at going to jail or doing this or doing that because you probably don't have the self-esteem, which we, you know, as clinicians, we talk with our clients about. Like, you may not have the self-esteem or the advocacy and agency at the time to be like, no, I don't want to do that. Or,
yeah.
no, I'm straight. I'm going to stick this one out. And it's what I'm dealing with, too. And I'm growing within myself. So it's definitely not a rant. I think it's definitely part of the conversation.
Yeah, you know, because I definitely was like that dude. Like, just thinking about, like, my earlier years, I didn't really want to have any kind of problems with nobody. But, of course.
Definitely.
You know what I'm saying? When those opportunities present themselves, it's either you ride or it's like, oh, man, we can't, you know what I'm saying? It's over with, you know what I'm saying, for your friendship. So, mm-hmm. So, and I think about, like, therapy, like I don't see a therapist now. I have before, you know what I'm saying? When I was about to get married, I was going through some things in my head, and I went and saw a therapist because I had an EAP. But I was thinking, like, in high school, you know what I'm saying, like, that probably would have been the best time, you know what I'm saying, where I could have benefited from seeing a therapist, because I had so many, like, conflicting views of things, you know what I'm saying, and I couldn't really talk to nobody about it because really I just didn't know how it would go, you know. So
mm-hmm.
So I think about those times, like, in high school, like, man, I probably could have been cool to sit down and talk to somebody who really didn't have any, you know, because even my mentors I had, like, those views of masculinity, you know what I'm saying? So it's like,
yeah.
So, well, shit, I can't really go, you know, talk to you about, you know what I'm saying, me just wanting to, like, you know, have, like, one girl, you know what I'm saying? I just want to chill, be a square, you know what I'm saying? Then I got my friend saying, oh, you need a couple just in case. It's like, damn, you know what I'm saying? That's a lot of work. You know, it was something I just didn't want to do, you know what I'm saying? So, and then, you know, you got, like, self-esteem issues, you know what I'm saying, those kind of things, and just high school stuff, you know, just adolescent stuff that makes life weird. Like, that would have been real cool to sit down and talk to. I don't think I knew what a therapist was when I was in high school, though, to be honest. Like, I don't even think I even knew what that, I had no idea, you know, that was just kind of, if you was, you know, if you lived in Lake Oswego, you probably knew what a therapist was, but not where I was from. Mm. You know, so
I think that, like, therapy now, like, I'm reading a book. I was actually reading before we got on the call called Black Man in a White Coat.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I think you posted that.
Yeah, huh?
I think you posted that.
Uh-huh, yeah. And he's talking about him going at first. I'm at the part where he's in his, like, I guess, residency or something like that.
Yeah.
And he's doing his different rotations, and there's definitely I definitely can understand where a lot of African-American, black people, people of color can come from, because, you know, this whole helping field and kind of like mental health can be in medicine in some places, but it definitely has discriminated against us for a while, and, you know, prenatal health and all this, the things that, you know, black women need for children is sorely lacking.
Yeah.
And I also say that, too, because is we want our people to seek services. And I think these services, just like going and getting a checkup, doing a physical, your eye exam, you know, the dentist, going and checking up with what's from the mental to the dental, should be good. Not even in a crisis situation.
Mm-hmm.
It should be just going and checking in. But just knowing the history of a lot of things, like, I suggest y'all go out and, you know, read this book. It's, kind of deep. And it's... It shows you that some of the ills that have been going on, but it's a history to us not seeking services as much, and then not having the access, and, you know, but, you know, people like Chris is, and I are people that, you know, want to vouch for it and hopefully make it more of a thing to do when you get everything else checked in, you know, check in with your mind as well, not even in a crisis or emergency situation.
Yeah. I definitely agree, and I do want to check that book out. You know what I'm saying? I know you posted it. I was like, oh, yeah, that's like, not a good one to read. But it is, you know, something like, you know, like growing up, you know what I'm saying? Like, you only went to the doctor when you, like, had to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And, you know, and you write about, you know what I'm saying, like, that comes from, like, this history of, like, you know, just of not being really well represented in the field. So it's like... It's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, because a lot of people don't trust doctors, you know what I'm saying? And they just don't. And, you know, just because it's a lot of things, you know what I'm saying? Like, we don't get the treatment we're supposed to get. And, you know, that could be because of bias or whatever. But you know, there's a discrepancy somewhere, you know what I'm saying, that needs to be addressed. And I feel like, yeah, he's doing it with that book. So let's get into, like, how does, you know, like, how do you feel that race and mental health are connected?
Whew. Man. Well, how much time do we have? That might be a whole nother, like, wow. So, yeah. So I think it definitely plays a lot into it. I feel as though, as a clinician, I feel as though I would assume that my clients, they probably like, okay, Josh is black. Let me speak to him. Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely that level of, like, I can be, usually, not all the time, but usually I can be more open and honest and talk. And I can get, you know, different services, because the average person who, I've had clients to be like, wait, that was it? Like, you didn't sit me on the couch and do this whole Sigmund Freud type relaxed release type thing.
Yeah.
And you just, the way we're talking, I think that us being who we are, just being, having black skin, that definitely, and knowing our clinical skills and all this stuff, that definitely breaks down barriers, because I think people look at, you know, race and mental health. It definitely stops a lot of client black and brown clients from coming in, because they feel as though these white people will not be able to understand where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even in a regular everyday sense, it's like you walk down the street and it's like, are this cop coming towards me? Or it definitely is in your everyday, or at least mine, my everyday thinking, like, I hope they ain't coming over here. I hope I'm not in trouble. I always feel like I have to explain myself or validate myself in a way. And that definitely impacts, you know, your mental health. So even from an everyday sense to in a job sense, it's cultural things that, white people, a lot of times, they'll put your business, like, how's this, how's that? They'll start asking, like, why are you asking me that?
You know.
I gotta move a certain type of way in here. Now I'm looked at as, like, the non-approachable black guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, that. There's other brothers that I work with, and we kind of, it's like an unwritten code. Like, we know what each other goes through. So, like, I can keep stuff and talk to this brother or that brother.
Yeah.
But, like, Becky social worker or something like that,
mm-hmm.
they start asking, like, yo, I start getting, like, real, like, what's it called? I just start not talking a lot. And I think it's, like, that can be looked at as you being an angry black man. So, mm-hmm. race and mental health definitely play in a lot of situations.
Yeah, that makes sense. What you're saying, like, culturally, we really don't, like, put our business out there like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, we kind of, mm-hmm. yeah, even though we talked about it at work, in a work setting, maybe, that still doesn't mean mm-hmm. I want, like, you know, everybody to know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I need everybody to know what's going on with me. Like, I probably told you something because, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, you know, but yeah, so I definitely feel that. I know, you know, like my supervisor, I have, you know, for my LCSW is a person of color. You know, she's an Asian woman. And I just like the fact that, you know what I'm saying? Like, I can, like, explain something, like, situation to her, and, like, I can say it might be racism, and she doesn't, like, question it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, she doesn't, like, well, you sure? You know, like, she's like, oh, yeah, it probably is. You know, because she's been, you know, like, you know, she's been through it as well. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I know you started a network on Instagram or in your practice called Melanated Social Work.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So is that, like, you by yourself, or is that you and, like, some of your peoples, you know, like, in Boston, or, like, do you mind going in and kind of explain a little bit about, like, you know what I'm saying, like, what's, you know, the purpose behind it, and, you know what I'm saying, how it started and where you wanted to go?
Certainly, certainly. So, Melanated Social Work came about, it was founded by me and three other brothers.
Mm-hmm.
We all went to Boston College, and at the time I was living in New York, and my boy Jesse, he was graduating BC with his MSW because I graduated a year before him. So I came back from Brooklyn to Boston on the low, and he didn't know. Mm-hmm. I knew he was having a party, so I surprised him. He was like, yo, Josh, you came? I was like, yeah, bro, you're my brother, man. This is what we do.
Yeah.
So it was me, Jesse, another brother by the name of Mike, and another brother by the name of Marvin. We took a picture, and I was thinking to myself, we're all MSWs. We're all melanated.
Yeah.
Melanated social work. And we took a picture, and I was like, that was that. And that was where the idea of the naming of it came. And then it also turned into, you know, at the time I was in New York, Mike was in Washington, D.C., Marvin is still in Philly, and Jesse's in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
We did a, what's it called, Skype peer supervision.
Yeah.
Just talk about stuff. And I'm going all over the place. We met at B.C., Boston College School of Social Work. You know, when you're in a social work class, you're probably, especially being a male of color, you're one of maybe the only one in the class. And we just always felt like, man, we felt like singled out or just isolated in a sense, but we just kept that connection.
Yeah.
So fast forward to us, you know, post-grad BC, we just kept in contact doing peer supervision. Like, we used to do it more. We don't do it as much because life picks up. You know what I'm saying? And we at least now do at least once a month meeting. But it just came out of a sense of, like, what is it like? Melanated social work came from, like, what is it like to be a person of color in social work in these institutions or in these agencies that you're the only person? And they'll sometimes, a lot of the white social workers, they'll come to you, talk about quote-unquote Jose or quote-unquote Tyrone.
Yeah.
Maria or Keisha and all this stuff, and you have to be that person, or the microaggressions that you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
We just started networking and talking about all this stuff, and we thought, what it would be like for us to network and talk about what it's like for us and others, and talk about what it's like to be, you know, maybe black and queer, black and disabled, Afro-Latino, what is it like to go to and speak to different clinicians of color? Just all the stuff that we kind of talk about and that you, you know, that you see on the page. Mm-hmm. You started, like, having all these ideas and, this person, Georgia Group, posted this. Dr. Jess, mm-hmm. who's on Breakfast Club, she does this. Or Dr. Joy Bradford does this.
Yeah.
This came out of what is important to us as clinicians of color in this work, to ban the wall, to talk about, you know, Black Lives Matter, to talk about Sandra Bland, all this stuff. Because, to be honest, all the shit that we post, basically, none of this stuff ever got covered at BC. Mm-hmm. I remember around the time Mike Brown, the whole case was going on.
Yeah.
Nobody addressed it at school. And we felt like, wow.
Yeah.
All this stuff is going on, and we're talking about this whole privilege line and white people saying, I'm really not that privileged. Like, I had to fight, too.
Yeah.
And just because I have a 2013 Honda Accord or I have a Passat and I grew up in the freaking suburbs of Boston, I have a struggle, too. It's like, okay, we've heard enough of that.
Yeah.
We talking about some real issues. So it just came out of a sense of stuff that we felt was left out of our curriculum.
Yeah.
Stuff that we experience and that people don't talk about, because in his work, and I'm reading in this book, Black Man in a White Coat, he felt sometimes race was left out, and sometimes you're in clinical, like a presentation meeting or mm-hmm. the rounds, as we say, and like certain cultural nuances, ethnic nuances, racial nuances, in my opinion, in my experiences, were always left out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did y'all ask about this? Did y'all ask about that? Totally glazed over.
Yeah.
So it came out of that. And right now, I'm based in Boston. Mike is in Western Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Marvin is in Philadelphia. And Jesse's in Oakland. And, you know, we spoke at BC almost 2 months ago. We got some other stuff in the works that I don't want to say because I don't want to jinx it. But we want to be able to go to other schools, speak about things, talk about masculinity, do panel discussions,
mm-hmm.
facilitate trainings. Just basically, it'd be dope to just have it as like a consulting firm or like a consulting agency.
Yeah.
It'd be dope if we can go speak to, you know, in some NBA team or an NFL team. I know that there's a sister, Tish Guerin, if I'm saying her name correctly. She is the Carolina Panthers director of player mm-hmm. wellness.
Yeah.
And she's the LCSW.
Yeah.
So it'd be cool to, like, what we want to do is just, like, how I'm a sports guy. So Deion Sanders at the time when he got drafted, he felt as though cornerbacks weren't getting paid and given the respect and their just due. So what we want to do is just put that mental health thing on our back as LCSWs, MSWs, what have you, put it on our back. Get the respect that we deserve, be able to get opportunities that we deserve, and get paid what we deserve. Because I feel as though, and this is just my thing, I'll get off my soapbox, but this is just my thing. I feel as though, and I might go get my PhD, but a lot of times in this world, in this work, people with doctorates in psychology or this and that and the third, they get a lot of, like, love and this and that. Mm-hmm. But it's like, we had a post the other day, and it was like, y'all know how many hours we have to sit for, how many hours we have to work
yeah.
to get this license and that license, the CEUs, like, that gets overlooked. And I can't get mad at people for them not knowing, but our licenses and credentials are just as good as somebody with a doctor and this yeah. and that. Because a lot of stuff that we do, nothing against them and a slight against them, is very practical and it's very, like, experience-based.
Yeah.
You know? So we're just trying to put the melanated social work on our back to give everybody their just due with black and brown skin to get the pay and opportunities that they deserve, man, because mm-hmm. it's a long time coming. And you look at this, nation in about, like, what, 2050 or so?
Yeah.
There's not going to be a lot of white people around.
Yeah.
So we are the culture, and we want to just push the ball forward and be able to be trailblazers in what we do.
Yeah.
You know, with respect to, like, you know, Whitney Young and all those, you know, black people that trailblazed, we looked at them and we're trying to, you know, push the ball forward for our people.
Yeah.
If that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I feel that. I think I'm on the same mission. You know what I'm saying? I'm doing it more like, you know, I'm by myself. So, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, I know, well, everybody who I've encountered with, hopefully, you know what I'm saying, we can all work together. But yeah, you know what I'm saying, like, you know, like, I got a vision board that's updated. I wrote down, like, all the schools that I would like to visit and engage mm-hmm. with students with, you know what I'm saying, engage with professionals, you know what I'm saying, just to really try to, just, I feel like, yeah, we talk about it a lot in our grad school classes about, like, you know, cultural competency and all that stuff, but I feel like to really put, like, some meat behind it, you know what I'm saying, like, okay, mm-hmm. this is what you think it means, but this is what this actually is meaning right now, you know what I'm saying, so, mm-hmm. yeah, I definitely like the movement, you know what I'm saying, but I do feel what you're saying about, you know, us not really getting, like, the you know, like, the props, you know what I'm saying, because we don't have, like, you know, like a Dr. Scott or something like that, you know what I'm saying, like, you know, when you're mm-hmm. a doctor, you know, that always going to hold more weight, you know what I'm saying, but at the same time, like you said, you know, we put in a lot of hours, you know what I'm saying, Definitely. Of hours, you know, just to, you know, so, yeah, so I definitely feel that, but I want to go back to what you said about, you know, about how you were speaking about, you know, like being, like, a black person or a Latino person that might be queer or something like that. I feel like in our communities of color, you know what I'm saying, we don't really address intersectionality if you're, like, a heterosexual person. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like if you're a homosexual, you know what I'm saying, of course you do. But, well, not of course, but, you know, you probably are. But I feel like, you know, like, in our work, it's like, especially with, like, amongst black males, I feel like, you know, we talk about, like, being black, and then, like, it's kind of, like, shut out. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, then that's it. So I just want mm-hmm. to say, like, I appreciate y'all, you know what I'm saying? Like, even, you know, like, you know, even though, like, I'm a heterosexual male, you know what I'm saying? Just to, you know, showing, like, true allyship. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. You know, so right. Just to, like, really speaking about intersectionalities, you know what I'm saying? That exists. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Whether we like it or not, whether we think it's an agenda being pushed or whatever, all kind of crazy stuff that I hear, it's out there. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And,
definitely.
And it needs to be addressed. So I appreciate that.
Right. I mean, we just try to be more so in solidarity with people. We don't try to, like, be a like a cheerleader to cheer people on and this and that. We try to be like, what can we do? How can we support? I'll be real. I don't know everything. I've been definitely, as it's called, called in. So maybe some of my views, and I appreciate that, to learn and grow. Yeah. And being able to call the brothers about maybe some problematic or toxic views. So it's definitely pretty cyclical. I'm glad I got my, you know, Melanie and social work brothers to keep me on my square. Mm-hmm. And also just for that support, because in this level of work, man, with all the stuff that we're going through and in the current political state, man, you need as much support and calling in as possible, man. Because I feel as though with us as, you know, heterosexual black men, you're right. The conversation definitely stops there. How can we be a voice? How can we support, you know, those that are queer, those are disabled, those that are sex workers, mm-hmm. Those that, you know, are not as able-bodied, or, you know, all the things, right? How can we be less transphobic? How can we not be, not less? How can we not, how can we not be transphobic, right? Mm-hmm. How can we just be supportive? Because, I mean, I'm all for, like, all Black lives mattering, right?
Mm-hmm.
Afro-Latino lives, you know, ones in the South, one out West, you know? Ain't no liberation without us all getting liberation, you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying?
Yeah, okay, I feel that. Yeah, thanks for speaking on that. I just feel like that's, like, a, you know, and, you know, me, myself included, I really don't speak on it a lot because it's not a life that I live, and I try to, like, to be, I try to be, like, not courteous, but what's the word I'm looking for? I just don't want, like, yeah, respectful, you know what I'm saying? Like, I just don't, mm-hmm. you know, it's not something that I go through, so, like, I don't want to, like, you know, overshadow or put my own experience or, like, I don't like to get into, like, you know, things that you know, if I'm not living, I don't like to give my opinion on it, because I feel like those kind of opinions are, like, not, like, okay, so what you're saying is you're speaking on what you think it is instead of, you know what I'm saying, like, right. What it actually is, you know what I'm saying? So I just know, like, you know, me hearing, like, you know, like, going to these trainings and hearing about, you know, all these, like, you know, things like equity and hearing somebody try to speak from my point of view, but it's like, I know I don't really appreciate that, you know what I'm saying? So, like, I try not to reciprocate it, you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
That's just, that's just, you know, something. But I feel like I could be better at showing allyship. You know what I'm saying? I could, you know, just, I don't know how, but I feel like I could be, you know.
I mean, I would say just, I think it probably goes more so with, like, being dairy more than allyship. And just, I think it also starts just listening, being there, putting in work, talking with people, letting people know, like, if there's somebody like a Tariq Nasheed calling that out and be like, that's not a place for this, or, you know, if you see somebody getting harassed or bullied, or, you know, feel like there's an injustice going on, definitely being able to speak up in their favor and back them up, because I think they, you know, we need as much support for all our people in general. And I will say, like, I'm still learning too. Like, we had a training, we have these, like, meetings twice a week, and I learned about, like, all, like, LGBTQI and the gender unicorns. And there's actually a health center here in Boston for those that, you know, identify as such. Yeah. And the thing is like, with the whole intersectionality thing, we can always work towards it, but it's kind of hard to get all this stuff because, you know, at this health, it's a health clinic that is for, I would say, more like LGBTQI and queer people. And there's, like, no people of color that are there. It's all a lot of white. So it's like, you have a lot of people of color coming in that identify as such, but speaking to white people. And I feel as though, what if I was in that setting? Would I not know this term? Would I not know that term? But it's, in a sense, just to, like, educate myself and try to be as on the ball as I know. Because I'll admit, I don't know all the things. And definitely grad school helped a lot, but just having a support of friends and network definitely helped me to learn more. I'm still learning, and this is going to be something I'm always going to have to learn at.
Yeah, I definitely feel like grad school really moved me, you know, a lot to, like as far as like intersectionalities. You know, I remember there was one assignment where we had to interview ourselves and then record it and then come back at the end of the assignment and, like, listen to yourself. Or and then, like, you write a paper about it, and, like some of the stuff you said in the beginning of the term, and then, you know, come back and listen to what you said after you went through, like, a term of, like, you know, kind of learning and unpacking your own issues. And I was like, damn, I was alarmed at some of the stuff I said. I was like, you know, because I never really would think, you know, saying that I would have, like, kind of, like, you know, like, I would have, like, you know, like, the capacity to say, like, things that are hurtful. And, you know, And then, like, you know, listening to myself speak like that, I was like, damn, that's kind of wild. So I do appreciate, you know what I'm saying, that part of grad school to kind of, like, let me, like, really learn about, like, intersectionalities and, like, you know, just how, you know, everybody needs support. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, we all need something, you know what I'm saying? And for me not to, you know, use, you know what I'm saying, my, you know, like, my lens and to put it on somebody else. As, like, you know, right. added to be, like, this is what, you know, say, like, you know, because as some, you know, like, you know, as black males, you know what I'm saying, like, we don't really, like, you know, I wouldn't say we have a lot of privilege, but, you know what I'm saying, we're still males and we're still, you know, hetero and all that kind of stuff. So, like, if...
Cisgender heterosexual.
You know what I'm saying? So, like, if I come through and try to put my lens on somebody who's, like, trying to figure their own stuff out, that could re-traumatize them.
Right.
You know, I definitely appreciated that. There were not a lot of assignments I appreciated in grad school, but that one was like, okay, that was worth my $5,000.
There was an assignment. It wasn't anything intersectionality related, but it was just a sense of, like, you know, but in a sense of biases and prejudice, we basically had to do an assignment where we looked ourselves in the mirror and talked about something that, it was my diversity class. We had to write a paper on something that we messed up, something that we said, and what we would do to rectify it, and just keeping yourself accountable moving forward to not do the same stuff. You know, you gotta look yourself in the mirror first, and it's good to have the support, but you gotta look at yourself in the mirror first, because again, like you said, you don't want your lens to be the lead lens for somebody who has a different lens. So that makes sense.
Yeah, I got you. I got you. All right, so Well, two quick questions. I gotta get out of here and go pick my daughter from my mom's house. What does social work look like in Boston?
I'm sorry, what's the question again?
What does social work look like in Boston?
Man, white as hell.
Okay.
It's very white. It's very white, female led. Mm-hmm. So, and it's a whole nother topic we can get into. Is at the panel we talked about the melanated social work. Mm-hmm. Our discussion on diversity and inclusion. We talked about us being black men, with the history of black men with white women going from Rosewood to Oklahoma City to Emmett Till. We got to walk on eggshell. So in Boston, if you look at the fans and stuff like that for the sports, the city of Boston has a lot of people of color. I'll say that. In certain areas outside. But overall, there's people who, like, you got, we touched New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut. It's some very non-diverse states. So a lot of those, since it has a lack of diversity, a lot of the stuff that is here is just, like, egregious. And a lot of white women not being able to see things from a non-white woman's sense. So, and they're the leaders. They're the ones that are the directors and the supervisors. So, you know how you said there's politics and this and that. You got to be able to navigate that. Mm-hmm. But I think that at the same time, there is a lot of support for people here. There's a lot of, like, you know, hospitals, health centers, you know, therapists, outpatient clinics. They definitely put into, and Boston is the capital of Massachusetts. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of, I guess, fiscal progressive things that they put into budget to make sure that people are getting the services that they need. My thing is like, and there's definitely a lot of different services for different, you know, populations, be it like maybe Latino, you know, Asian, queer. So there's definitely a lot of opportunities. It's just we need more people in from those communities at the heads of the table to push the ball forward. So that's where the level is. And I'd rather it's better than, like, say, I think services here are better than, like, in Florida. Because in Florida, there's only one license that you have, and there's not a lot of opportunities. They're not going to put a lot of money into the budget fiscally in Tallahassee, which is the capital of Florida, to get services and to get outcomes. So, yeah.
Okay.
Massachusetts is Massachusetts.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds a lot like Portland, to be honest. But, like, you guys have more sports teams, of course, but...
sports teams, though.
Well, you don't?
Hell no.
You're not a Red Sox guy? My fault.
Who are they? Oh,
that's okay. That brought up some pain right there.
See, the thing is, and I'm bringing it back to race. Like, so there's a guy named Howard Bryant. He had his book called Shutout, and it talked about race and baseball and baseball and them desegregating the schools in the 70s. Redlining,
yeah.
The Red Sox shutting the doors to Jackie Robinson and not letting him try out, even though they had one open for him. I mean, the Bruins booing. They have a history of booing a lot of black players, but doing stuff to P.K. Subban, who is now in the Nashville Predators. Dominique Foxworth talking about being called nigger in Gillette Stadium. Mm-hmm. Or even DeMarcus Cousins, who he got called something racial at the TD Garden the other day. And it's just, Bill Russell dealing with what the shit he dealt with.
Yeah, I remember. I used to be, like, in the hoop history. You know, I remember, you know, I was younger, and I remember him talking about that.
Right, and I mean, racism happens everywhere. There's a special place in race hell for these anti-black, anti-Latino, white supremacist supporters.
Yeah.
And I mean, Boston has championship racism to match the championship of their sports, and that goes into social work. But let me get off my soapbox.
Well, okay. Well, hey, man, you're right. I mean, because when it's that deep, you know, it's that deep. I mean, you know, like, if it's all connected, it's connected. If, you know, facts are facts, you know, so.
it's a very passive aggressive racism here. Like, I lived in Florida before.
Yeah.
And when you fucking Confederate flag or somebody called you out your name, you knew what it was. But it's something to where when you have to process it in your head, the microaggressions and what have you, or like me having more, like one time I had in a sense, there was somebody who did, a white man who didn't have my credentials, none of that, but yet he got the job. But
yeah.
I was told that my qualifications didn't meet anything. So, but they tell you really did a good job. Like, you don't got to tell me all that.
Yeah.
It's very passive here, man.
Yeah.
And it messes with the psyche because you can't get closure on, was that racist or not?
Yeah. That's, I was explaining to that, to one of my old coworkers, like, you know, like just being a black person, it's like you like especially in a place like Portland, because you know, like in regards of Portland and Boston, that sounds pretty similar. You know what I'm saying? Like the kind of passive aggressive stuff. So it's like you never really know. You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, was that because you know I was black, or was it because you know, like, so like, yeah, I feel like that does mess with your psyche, because you really just, you know, because it's not as blatant, so you really just don't know. And you know, and they try to walk around it and the stuff. It's like just don't walk around it. Just keep it at 100. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it is what it is. I'm not going, you know, so, like, you know, don't insult my intelligence.
Definitely. You
know, don't do that.
And y'all were a sundown town, too.
Portland, yeah.
There's a statue out there with, like, indigenous people, and it was something to do with when the white man came. It's some
we got,
statue or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of that here. I mean, not in Portland per se, but, like, Dallas, Oregon. Roseburg, Oregon, like, you know, southern Oregon, eastern Oregon, you know, like, there's like maybe four towns where, like, I feel like, all right, this is cool, you know what I'm saying? But, like, yeah, a lot of times I'm always, like, you know, my head's on a swivel, because, like, you know, because...
Definitely.
Because you're right, you know, like, sundown towns are a thing. They still have, like I was saying, Dallas has a sundown rule, but it's not enforced. You know, but they never took it off the books, but they just don't enforce it.
And I mean, Oregon was founded for basically white people to go to, and it not to be any type of pigmentation in there at all. And
yeah.
I've heard stuff about Klan and all this stuff with the Rose Guard.
Yeah.
But yeah,
yeah, they have, now they're starting to bring up the history of, you know, because I think how white Oregon was, people started really asking questions like, why is this a certain way? You know what I'm saying? People started asking questions. So now a lot of history of it is is getting brought up, and people are like really learning, you know, the truth of, like, you know, why. Now, some people care, some people don't. You know what I'm saying? You can't make everybody care, but it is gaining a movement, you know what I'm saying? Like, of why, you know what I'm saying, looks this way in Oregon. But, last question before I let you go. How does Josh take care of himself?
Oh, wow. So, I do a lot of things, man. So, I think one thing that I hadn't been doing that I'm starting to do more so now is just, like, eating more fruits and vegetables, drinking more water.
Mm-hmm.
Just eating better in general, not eating as late, doing a little fasting. So, eating right. Trying to get enough sleep, trying to read more, turning off my phone or putting it to, like, do not disturb, so I'm not on social media and nothing like that. So just unplugging, you know, trying to speak with my family, stay in touch with my loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
I go to acupuncture. Acupuncture is a really good one that really helps out with stress. It is not as painful as people may think.
Yeah.
I go to a therapist, and I work out. And I like listening to, like, I listen to a lot of podcasts, but, like, there's one called, it's not a podcast, it's called Dead End Hip Hop, or Is the Mic Still On?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones I like to listen to. Yeah, and that's basically it. And I like to clean my bathroom. That's kind of like what I like to do. I get in my bag when I clean my bathroom.
Yeah, hey, bathrooms is a place that need a lot of it. You feel me? They need a lot of cleaning in there. All right, well, man, I appreciate you, connecting on this, you know, this beautiful morning. yeah, I just everything you're doing, you know what I'm saying, you know, with the Melanated social work, I love that platform.
Thank you.
I just love that, you know, we out here, we trying to build something that's, you know, that's needed, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
and we love your platform, and thank you for all you do in Portland. You put me on to, like, what's it called, C4?
Yeah, C4, yeah.
C4 Portland, and you had somebody from, like, he's like the traveling social worker or something like that.
Yeah, my guy.
Him and, yeah, and just all the stuff that you're doing too, man. Portland, man. Props to you, man. You know, hopefully one day we'll be able to connect out there. You know what
yeah.
I'm saying?
Yeah, there's definitely. We can do that.
Yes, sir.
All right, player. Appreciate it.
All right, man. Have a good one, man.
You too.
Thank you for everything.
Yes, sir. You too, man.
Peace.
All right, now we back, and you know, shout out to Josh for you know, coming through and dropping some of his social work knowledge and sharing his journey, and you know, him building Melanated Social Work Network with you know, with some of the people he met in grad school and all that stuff. He didn't shout out his Instagram tags and all that. Kind of forgot about it, you know. But I kind of spaced it. But, you know, if you want to follow him, he is, his social work name is, our Instagram name is The Bearded Social Worker. And also you can follow Melanated Social Work on Instagram as well. But I'm not going to do a diagnosis of the week this week. As some of you probably heard today that, you know, rapper Nipsey Hussle was gunned down in L.A., you know what I'm saying? And it's just it's kind of meant to threw me for a loop, you know what I'm saying? It fucked me up a little bit just because, you know, I really don't get too sentimental over, like, you know, public figures passing, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, this one, it was hard because, like, every interview I watched with Nipsey Hussle, he was always, like, dropping some kind of knowledge, you know what I'm saying? Really just had good energy. You could tell that he wanted the best for his people, you know what I'm saying? He wanted the best for everybody, you know? He was in the community. He was trying to buy back the block and all that stuff. You know, really giving good game just entrepreneurship. If you're creative, you know what I'm saying, on your own catalog, you know what I'm saying? I know a few years ago, he had really put the test on, like, you know, how you value your own work. I remember he put out a CD and it was $100, you know what I'm saying? People was tripping, like, oh, man, ain't nobody buy that CD. But people bought it, you know what I'm saying? Because that's just the way he was moving, and that's the kind of love he showed, and people showed the same love back, you know what I'm saying? Like you were watching a Nipsey Hussle interview and just leave, like, smarter, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't about drama and BS and, you know, all that kind of stuff that most interviews are shown to us. You listen to one of his interviews and you really would, you know, understand, you know what I'm saying, like, how to make your next move, you know? I know last year when I was, trying to really figure out the hip-hop social worker thing, you know, the album A Victory Lap came out, and the title song, just listen to that, you know what I'm saying, it's that beat and what he was talking about and how he was flowing, it really just put something through me, you know what I'm saying, and I just was looking at things different, you know what I'm saying, I was looking at everything I was trying to do differently, you know, I mean, I wasn't really in a place, you know, to take an L, you know what I'm saying, just because I was just vibing, and that song just put, like, a spirit in me. It's like, all right, well, if we're going to make it happen, if it don't happen, we're going to know that we gave it, you know what I'm saying, 110. So, yeah, it just kind of fucked me up, man, to hear, you know what I'm saying, Nipsey Hussle, you know what I'm saying, to go down like that, you know. And really, you know what I'm saying, it really, like, triggers, like, you know what I'm saying, just kind of some thoughts that I have, just being, like, African-American man. You know what I'm saying, this country, you know, it's just hard, and, you know, you always kind of think about, you know what I'm saying, like it's a day of the day where I get harmed, you know, or where I get disrupted, you know. I always have, like, this fear that, like, you know, like, something happens and I can't get to my daughter, you know what I'm saying? Like, and then she's left to kind of figure it out. Even though she's won, you know what I'm saying, you know, life don't stop. And she's left to figure out, you know what I'm saying, are the people who are taking care of her at that moment to figure out what to do with her and how to get her to the next, you know, to the nearest family member or my wife or something. And I just know, like, I know he had a daughter and a wife, you know what I'm saying? And it's just sad, you know, like, it really just is, you know what I'm saying? And to see a man have to leave his legacy behind like that, you know what I'm saying? And we just, more trauma that we got to deal with, you know what I'm saying? And then, yeah, it's just a fucked up situation. And, you know, I'm praying for the best, you know what I'm saying, for his fam. And, you know, I know, you know what I'm saying, a lot of people, you know, might think that just because, you know what I'm saying, they was upper class, and it's like, nah, some things money can't buy, you know what I'm saying? Some things money can't replace, you know. Growing up without a dad is going to be rough, you know what I'm saying? It's going to be hard, you know. They're going to need a lot of support. And it just was a sad day in hip-hop. For real, you know, R.I.P. Nipsey Hussle, and, you know, I shed a few tears for him just because, man, the energy, every time I checked in, you know what I'm saying, and watched something or listened to something, he was just spitting good game. And it's, you know, it's really fucking us up. So, appreciate Josh sliding through once again. You know where to find this at, Hip-Hop Social Worker, hiphopsocialworker.com. Instagram, everything's Hip Hop Social Worker, except Twitter, because I can't fit it. HH Social Work, C4PDX. If you're a clinician of color, or you're looking for clinicians of colors to build with, go to C4PDX.com. And also, you know, I am taking clients now in my practice. I'm contracting with the company. If you want to learn how to send a referral to me, go to hiphopsocialworker.com. Peace. Be easy.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.